No, Mr. President, I haven't. I backed away from that. Bill told me he didn't think you were going to talk Vietnam. I have got all the raw material, and if you want to talk it, I'll just do nothing else.
Well, now, what do you think? I don't think you can go and talk without talking.
Well, I think you got to say something. I don't think you ought to, I don't think it's the occasion for kind of a full dress Vietnam speech. I think it ought to have some paragraphs, and what I thought we'd do is, if Harry was working on the basic skeleton, we ought then to decide what two or three propositions we wanted to make and write them in as your comment on the situation as of Wednesday night rather than a full-dress speech. Incidentally, have you read Life this week?
No, but the Luce called me
it's
a couple of times.
Very important. Well done.
He told me that.
A little critical of us as to how we explain ourselves, but
yes,
very good about our policy.
He said, is it merited? Is criticism merited?
I don't think we've done a perfect job, to be honest with you.
Well, I mean, do they point out that we don't do it often enough, or
no,
we don't do it thorough enough?
I think what he's talking about is, well, you ought to read it. It's Hedley Donovan. It's quite thoughtful, and what I think his worry is that the sort of how of what we're doing hasn't been explained. The basic policy, as Ruskin Taylor stated it, is clear, but what are our troops actually doing, and when do we get out of there, and what about the risk of escalation, and why does it... I don't think anyone can say we haven't said why, but I think people can say that what and how we haven't...
Well, do we know when we're going to get out of there?
No, we don't.
What?
That's, of course, there's no solution to that part of it, I'll admit.
I think we ought to say everything we can say without helping the enemy, and that might be what we do there.
Actually...
I rather think if we could, we ought to say that we appreciate this... freedom award, that if there's anything in the world that we want in the world, it's freedom. And the thing next to wanting freedom is we want the world to know that that we never in any way going to endanger it and try to act as an imperialist or protector or whatever you want to say. We're just not going to do that. And the Philippines is a good example. But we are in the Vietnam because we thought to warn them that we could deter aggression, and if we couldn't deter it by agreeing to stop it, that we could stop it. That's the only purpose we have in mind, that while most wars you just really have to hate the people you're fighting, that we don't hate these folks, that we want them to go back across the line, and then we want to work with them to rebuild that area of the world, and as we've demonstrated, and the Asian Bank has come along now, and we want to sit down with them and arrange for procedures to have an election in South Vietnam, and we want to see them form political parties. We want to see them select their officials, and we want to contribute to what resources we can to avoiding inflationary destruction and to building a stable area and seeing them develop their resources. And we said we talked their 4 points. We don't reject them out of hand. They're not ours, they're theirs, but we're willing to talk them, and we're sure we would embrace them. Some of them, that we would like to have them consider some of ours, and we'd talk them, and we would be glad to bring up and have them bring up some that non-aligned nations have suggested, and we believe it's better to talk than fight, and we're ready to do it. And if they stop their aggression, stop fighting, we'll stop fighting. If they move their troops out, we'd move our troops out. If they would come on to the table, we could bring up every suggestion we want to. That what we want to do is for all the Viet Cong in South Vietnam and for all the people of Asia, we want to do what we're trying to do in the pacified area, extend the lifespan, drive illiteracy underground, banish disease, and try to take some of our surplus bins and put them in the stomachs of poor, hungry people and build a mighty, hearty, stable society. And I think you just say as much as we can about what we would like to do that we don't ask you to give up your pride. We don't ask you to crawl on your stomach. All we ask you to do is just proudly, if you want to, walk into a meeting hall with us and to reason and talk and be prepared to give and take. And we'll try to do the same thing. I don't know. You just got to know that we're not going to get out. And we don't think that you're going to take it over. And we think that if you're willing to let them decide it, that that ought to be fair to everybody. I think you pretty well answered Bobby that way, and I think you pretty well...
Your answer is logic, but the psychology. You noticed three times today he came back to the casual is in the Chinese. And these, I think, are the places where the needle goes in terms of people's fears. And this...
Yes, I think everything we've ever had, we have... We've had that, but gosh, he's real inconsistent. Following Fulbright's theory and talking about how careful measure they were. Fulbright was dropping bombs on Cuba, as I remember, and saying, let's do it right now. And as Joint Chiefs of Staff, as I understood it, signed the letter. And Taylor first agreed with it and then backed off of it a little bit the day before. Isn't that correct?
I don't remember Max's position.
Well, didn't they recommend taking them out?
They certainly were airstrike plus invasion, really.
I was told by my military aide that he was told that they had signed it, that Taylor was on board, that he signed it, that he was going to take it over, that he talked to somebody, and then called them back in and said that he wanted to interpret it a little differently, and he backed away from it. At that very moment. And a good many people over there who were gossipers and who are still gossipers were of the opinion that the commies knew about that, and that's why Khrushchev came in when he did. They knew that we were getting ready to do this. They had their leaks, and that it's kind of like Eisenhower's leak.
I've always thought that the prospect of invasion had more to do with the solution than any other one thing. I couldn't prove it, but I just think that it looked awful imminent.
Now, this is interesting. He said the great source of concern in the Senate, the speeches of Stennis.
Yeah.
They scare the hell out of us.
I believe that.
Because we all know, as Simon implied, that he gets his information from the Joint Staff. The other day, General McConnell from Arkansas was by to see me, complaining that his hands are tied out there. Of course, I was glad they are. Fulbright.
Yeah.
He oughtn't to be doing that.
No. No.
Huh?
Joy.
He suggested that we should send a secret emissary to Ho Chi Minh to persuade him that negotiation would provide him a fair deal, that we absolutely, without reservation, want no basis of any kind. He suggested someone like Will Clayton, who's dead, or Eugene Black. He has heard that senators are tinkering with resolutions. He's tinkering with them himself. He believes there are 20 to 30 skeptics about the war, most of whom would vote for a moderating resolution. He volunteered a conviction that resolution only stir up hornets.
This is all Bill Fulbright's
yes. Account. Give them another opportunity to get their stings in that would keep the debate going. He reiterated that he feels that the 2030 group have great worries about the war. He concluded it doesn't look that way to me at this moment. He does not believe they'll coalesce into a bloc capable of putting a resolution before the Senate. He went on at this point to say their basic problem is a lack of rapport with the president. Most of them don't feel in like they used to feel in with him. They see too much of Rusk and McNamara. You hear people griping that he takes us for granted.
This
Fulbright, I don't think, except for a handful, that is all personal. They have great respect for the president. They know him to be a very strong man who is trying to do everything he can. They believe he's kept things under reasonably good control. They do feel there's been inadequate communication. He did not make suggestions at this point. In fact, seemed to be excluding himself. Not because there's been no communication, but because his own doubts and fears are pathological. It is my strong opinion, after listening to him for more than 2 hours, that one, he is opposed to our presence in South Vietnam. Basically defeatist in nature toward any Western white involvement in Asia. He is very concerned about escalation and uncertain how to define either his current concern or escalation. He is irretrievably committed to doubts which put him beyond any pale of reasoning. He is personally very intolerant of Secretary Rusk as a person and as secretary. On the latter, he kept saying it is Rusk's statements about victory that give him almost as much worry as Stennis's. At this point, he would quietly compliment the White House for their caution and the deflation of the statements that we make from time to time.
He did that to me the other day, too. He tried to drive a wedge between us and Rusk.
Yes, he adds, he has nothing, though. He doesn't come in with anything. Now, I think we ought to have an agenda so we just don't visit, because this is Washington's birthday, and we had our Saturday where everybody could get it off their heart. I think that we ought to discuss, yes, by all means. I think we ought to try to discuss the briefing, the vice president, so that we can set that up as soon as we hear from him. But we ought to clear it to, on our level. I think we ought to talk further about Kintner. And
he's coming to lunch today, isn't he?
Yes, I think so. And I think we might just have him in and meet him. I rather think we ought to have Clark there today, too. Clark Clifford.
You have rather a big meeting if you're going to talk names of people. That's the only
Yes.
But still.
They're
all trustworthy, I think. This is a terribly important appointment, this Kintner appointment.
Yes, I think so.
A very good one, the more I think about it.
Kintner has the alcohol problem, and that's all I believe that worries me. And it means we take on NBC. And I don't know whether we can take on New York Times and NBC. I don't know whether you can ever beat the Times in this country, because not what the Times does in New York or what it does in Washington, what it does all over America. Every person that I know, from Marianne Means to the Bill White to the Country Weekly, read it.
Sure.
And then sit down and rewrite it as their own. Now, they don't always... Bill White doesn't agree with it. The Weekly doesn't necessarily, but most of them do. They're lazy intellectually, and they don't dig out these things, and then they take them and read them, and that's what we're getting. And I think we're getting a terrible beating on NBC and CBS every day. I watch it very carefully, and there's no question what Severide's very much against us. There's no question what Cronkite's very much against us. I didn't think he had any conviction on anything. There's no question, my judgment, what Paley has let the boom down. And there's no question what Sarnoff, in my judgment, is against Asia. And what I'm terribly fearful of is all the Jews are. That's what I'm really worrying about them, because they're looking. And I just felt real... distressed about my meeting with Arthur yesterday. It was a long meeting. It was very unproductive. He talked about everything, including his boyhood, his negotiating experience, his successes at the United Nations, the future of the United Nations, why he was not invited to Honolulu, what a mistake it was, how Drew Pearson was playing it up, and how he tried to explain to Drew that he couldn't have gone if he had been invited, but that he hadn't been invited, and that he was not like Adelaide, but Adelaide was disloyal and went every day complaining about the Washington and Rusk and Bundy and Kennedy, but that his only strength was his friendship with me, and that he really hadn't said that we lack credibility or we need to establish credibility, that was a lie, and that he really hadn't said the other day that he was for the prolonging the pause, and that John McCloy had gone out, stuck a knife in him, and gone to Utah. And she ought to tell McCloy that please don't discuss these meetings with Utah. That he'd gone to Utah to show how smart he was, and said that one thing about it, the strongest man that stands up to tell the president where to head in is Arthur Goldberg. And he wrote,